Hi, everyone. My name is Michelle from The Table in Uniontown. Thanks for tuning into our podcast this week. We're happy you're here. This is the live recording from this Sunday's sermon. We hope that as you listen, you'll more deeply understand the truth of God's word and how much he loves you. Let's jump in.
Ecclesiastes 4, 4 through 12. I saw that all labor and all skillful work is due to one person's jealousy of another. This too is futile and a pursuit of the wind. The fool folds his arms and consumes his own flesh. Better one handful with rest than two handfuls with effort and a pursuit of the wind. Again, I saw futility under the sun. There is a person without a companion, without even a son or brother. And though there is no end to all his struggles, his eyes are still not content with riches. Who am I struggling for, he asks, and depriving myself of good things? This too is futile and a miserable task. Two are better than one because they have a good reward for their efforts. For if either falls, his companion can lift him up. But pity the one who falls without another to lift him up. Also, if two lie down together, they can keep warm. But how can one person alone keep warm? And if someone overpowers one person, two can resist him. A cord of three strands is not easily broken. This is the word of the Lord.
Well, good morning. Do you ever feel like you just have to be the best? Really, do you? Do you look at your profession and do you just have the need to be better than the next person? This is common for athletes, ones we admire even. The late Kobe Bryant, who I quite like because he had a killer instinct that only Michael Jordan could match on the basketball court, said this: rest at the end, not in the middle. And he also said, I'd always see things in an opponent like, that guy is not going to outwork me today. He's not going to win this day. Or Jerry Rice had said, I hated days off. A day off felt like I was losing ground. And he added, if I saw a person working harder than me, I would push myself harder. These types of perspectives are common, or at least we think they should be common, in athletes. But Kohelet, the narrator of Ecclesiastes, the philosophy professor of sorts, he tells us maybe these attitudes, that they're common in salespeople and accountants and engineers and teachers and factory workers and even pastors. I saw that all labor and all skillful work is due to one person's jealousy of another, he tells us. We don't want to be just good. We don't want to just be excellent for the glory of God. We want to be excellent for the glory of ourselves. We want to be the best at work, many of us. I don't want to just preach a sermon that hits your heart, that God uses to change your life and that puts Christ at the center and says he is worthy of praise and honor. On a bad morning, I want to preach a sermon that's better than the one being preached down the street in every direction. At my worst, I want to preach a sermon that's better than the sermons that you heard at your last church. Perhaps you don't just want to sell product for the glory of God. You want to outsell your neighbor. In athletics, this is the norm. It's competition. We want that from the athletes we admire, right? I want Shohei Ohtani to go out and try to be better than every other baseball player on planet Earth. And he is. But we, as a society, as a church, as humans, we don't need to treat our work that way. But what does Kohelet say? All labor and all skill for work, it's due to one person's jealousy of another. When he sees under the sun people working really hard, he sees that it's all jealousy. All the striving, it comes from jealousy. And jealousy of what? Well, I have three thoughts here. I think there are quite likely more, but here are the three big ones that are apparent to me. We get jealous when that person is more skilled than me, that person has more accolades than me, and that person has more stuff than me. We get jealous of those things, don't we? That person is more skilled than me. We want to do something, and someone does it better, and it makes us jealous, and that jealousy either leads us to quit, as we'll examine in a few minutes, or it leads us to do the extreme mentioned here, where we just work like crazy to catch up with them. We become jealous of another person when they do the thing that we do, and they unfortunately, they do it better than us. They just do it better than us, and we cannot live with that. Imagine at your job that you are so esteemed. Maybe you don't have to imagine. Maybe you're like, this just is how it is at work for me. I'm the man. But imagine that you're so esteemed that your boss comes up to you and they give you an apprentice or they give you an intern, someone to learn from you, someone to take under your wing. You hold your head a little higher, right? Because your boss thinks so much of you that you're going to train this person up and that everyone's going to think they're great. And of course, they're going to be great because you're great. They're learning from the best. Well, in about a month, your little protege, they begin to outshine you. They outsell you. They outnurse you. They out-whatever you, whatever it is that you do. And you start to hear your colleagues say how great they are. As you expected. Your boss says how great they are, as you expected. But wait, did you just hear somebody whisper that they might be better than you right now? Are you happy for them? Or are you undone by this? Are you glad to have another strong talent on your team, or jealous that you might get outshone by this new prospect? This is why I can't let Randy and Joe and Nathan preach too much here at the table, right? You might like them better than me. I might become my own example. The second thing that causes us jealousy and causes us to work harder and harder and more with increased angst is someone having more accolades than us. We keep getting overlooked. We don't get the promotion. We don't get the raise. We don't get the title. We don't get the new office. We're still in a cubicle. We don't get the foreman position. We still have to listen to somebody else. We don't get the name tag with manager underneath it. Ours still says associate. And for some of us, it just isn't enough. For some of us, it's maddening. For some of us, it will consume us. And then the third way we become jealous, and it causes us more work and more angst in our work. It's not necessarily a jealousy involving our coworkers, though it could be, but it's that people have more than us. You look at the neighbors, and they're getting a pool. You don't have a pool. You look at the neighbors, and their kids have four-wheelers. Your kids don't. They go on vacation. You stay home. They go out to eat every night. You cook. Did they just get a boat? Are you kidding me? That's it. I'll work harder. I'll get promoted. I'll pick up shifts. I'll work longer hours, and on it goes.
They may have a pool. You may have a pool of debt. I mean,
that's right. That's right. That's right. Work is broken. Work is broken. Remember about 6 weeks ago, we said work isn't the curse, but work has been cursed, right? Kohelet this morning is showing us some of the cursedness of work. He sees what we don't, that under the sun, when not just done for the glory of God, striving isn't neutral and never can be. Rather, it has an envious underlying note that is sinful. James 3:16 reminds us, "For where there is envy and selfish ambition, there is disorder and every evil practice." So we're half a verse in so far this morning. We're doing good. This is futile. It's a pursuit of the wind. If you're working this way, he says it's herding wind, that phrase of trying to herd the wind. It's meaningless. It's pointless. It's impossible. And he says the fool folds his arms and consumes his own flesh. Now Kohelet gives us another reaction to envy, or at least when you find yourself unhappy with work and its results. When you see someone with more skills than you, when you see someone with more accolades than you, when you see someone with more stuff than you, you might work your butt off to catch up and surpass them in one or all of those areas. You might do that, sure. That might be your natural disposition. Or maybe you do it first. But what if you work and work and work and you do the best that you possibly can, but you don't actually get better than them? You don't get the accolades to match. You don't become better than them. You don't receive the boost in pay. You can't upgrade your lifestyle. Then what happens? You fold your arms. I've worked so hard. What do I have to show for it? So I'll just grow bitter. I'll just withdraw. The boss doesn't care anyways. No one sees me. No one appreciates me. No one praises me. No one rewards me. I do a good job. I'm in this position. I do less. I'm still in this position. Who cares, right? Who cares? Guess it doesn't really matter at all. And don't you see, regardless of the outcomes, regardless of whether the cheese goes out to distribution at the end of your shift, or the Excel files are up to date, or the shelves are stocked, or the schedule is made, regardless of that, something is happening in your heart. Something is happening to your mental state. Something is infecting you spiritually. You're becoming angrier. You're becoming more bitter. You're not working for God's glory. You're not working like someone who knows that God is watching, that God sees you. Instead, you're working for you. And that's true of both of these kinds of employees. I worked with a woman, and I told this story before. I've been in ministry for 10 years as of a couple months ago, so now I'm in the repeat time of my ministry where I tell stories over and over again. But I worked with this woman, and she was a fantastic worker. Just like her production was great. This was in the factory job I had. She worked overtime. She worked hard. She came in early. She busted her back doing physical labor. And the whole time she did it with a scowl on her face. And the whole time she did it, letting it be clear that she was not lazy and you were, and she was better than you at her job. And then one day I was working with her, one morning, like 5 a.m., and she had just gotten wind of someone suggesting that perhaps she was a little bit unpleasant at work. Not sure why. And she was kind of ranting about this to me, and she said, "That's fine, Joey, because I do my work for God." And you can see the confusion here. This person was grouchy and angry, and they worked in that way, and they treated their coworkers that way. And she had the lack of awareness to tell me that she does that for God. God was probably like, "Thanks, but no thanks, ma'am," right? We can work hard, and it can be turning us into more bitter and more polarizing, angry people. Or we can withdraw from work and have the same result. Work is a broken thing. So how do we do it rightly? How do we do it rightly? Better one handful with rest than two handfuls with effort and a pursuit of the wind. What does he mean here? It's better to have one handful. It's better to have just this much and to be content and to have peace and to rest. It's better to do that than to keep chasing and accumulating and trying to climb the ladder. You see, here's the contrast Kohelet's setting up. It's either we chase and chase and chase and more and more and more and better and better and better until we die, or we have enough at some point. You can have one handful and you can say, "That's good. That's plenty." Or you can have two handfuls and you can say, "More, more, give me more." And implicitly, you can have one handful too and you can say, "More, more," and chase and never get it, and it's the same problem. The question is, when you have one handful, what's your posture? With whatever you have, what's your posture? David Gibson says this, and it's important because this is the key to the one handful with rest posture to life. He says, "The universe you inhabit and the life you have today come from God's hand is something you do not deserve. Your life is on loan for a short while, and one day God will call time and take it back, just like the library will recall that overdue book on your shelf. So embrace life for what it is rather than what you'd like it to be. Live it before God with reverence and obedience. This is the pathway to joy, even though as you walk it, there will be mystery and pain. Have some nice food. Enjoy a good wine if you want, but be sure to enjoy whatever good things come your way." Ecclesiastes 3, 12 through 14, which we didn't touch on last week, says, "I know that there is nothing better for them than to rejoice and enjoy the good life. It is also the gift of God whenever anyone eats, drinks, and enjoys all his efforts. I know that everything God does will last forever. There is no adding to it or taking from it. God works so that people will be in awe of him. We don't have an amount that the teacher prescribes for what a handful is. But we do know that at some point we need to ask, is it ever enough? Are we enjoying whatever God has placed in our hands? Will we ever, can we in this present moment rest? It's the third way between lazy, withdrawn worker and workaholic. It's the idea of enough. G.K. Chesterton wisely said, there are two ways to get enough. One is to accumulate more and more. The other is to desire less. That's the third way. That's the sensible way. That's the path to rest. Do we always want more, or is there room in our lives? Is there a place in our lives right now to say, I'm content? Contentment, it's not mediocrity, it's not settling in a negative sense. Contentment, though, is a beautiful place of peace and rest. Better one hand full and at peaceful rest than trying to fill both hands and then some. But there's another idea to this component that we will see, and it's this idea of neighbor that he introduces. We can work out of jealousy, we can have two hands full, still be piling up awards and wealth, filling the trophy case, filling the garage, filling our schedule with vacations, and live in our hearts opposed to our neighbor. Or we can have one hand full and be at rest and live with love for our neighbor. The next verses talk about that relationship with neighbor. Our work, if it's out of jealousy, it will in ways isolate us from our neighbor. If that guy is doing better than us and that causes us to be resentful, how well can we really love them? How well can we really love them? If it's us against the world, trying to pull ourselves up, trying to pull our status up, trying to compete with everyone else, how can we love the world? How can we love the people around us? He picks up here in verse 7. Again, I saw futility under the sun. There is a person without a companion, without even a son or brother. And though there's no end to all his struggle, his eyes are still not content with riches. Who am I struggling for, he asks. Am I depriving myself of good things? This too is futile and a miserable task. The person, Kohelet shows us, has no companion. He works nonstop. There's no end to his struggle. And yet he asks the question, who am I even struggling for? There's a loneliness to working this way. You can achieve and acquire and win and climb. And at the end of the day, you can be alone. You can have no friends. You can experience no companionship. You can go home to an empty large house and watch TV on the biggest screen imaginable by yourself and fall asleep alone, and that can be your life. And you can also do this and not even be super successful by worldly standards. You can struggle to fill up both hands and still live this way because it's all about your perspective. It's all about your mindset. It's all about your orientation towards work and towards your neighbor. It's not about actually having two hands full. It's about the pursuit of having two hands full. It's about never having enough. It's a miserable task. It's a miserable life. It's futile. It's hevel. It's the vapor life. Who am I struggling for? That's the question brought before us in the text. Who am I struggling for? Is it just you? Is it the extension of you that is your household? That's a little better, right? But that's still kind of you too, isn't it? At least a little bit. I mean, please provide for your household, but don't think that since you don't live alone that that settles this issue, that you're free from listening to this text this morning. Two are better than one because they have a good reward for their efforts. He's emphasizing the simple idea of working together, working for one another, not being on an island. The more you can accomplish together. I work alone here. And not by choice, but it's just where we are as a church. And if you ask me, what is the hardest thing about church planting? I wouldn't even pause to tell you it's being alone. So I'm alone. I hate it. I hope we eventually grow and both need and can support more staff so that I'm not alone anymore. That's a dream I have for this church. He says that if two lie down together, they can keep warm. But how can one person alone keep warm? Weird, but true. We need each other. Interdependence is beautiful. In a world that often wants to push us to do for ourselves, to worry about ourselves, to worry about our own, to look out for number one, the church is the place of interdependence where we can lean on one another. Church is, can be, should be a beautiful community of interdependence with no equal in our world, with no equal in our culture. Keller said, "Our human lives are as fragile as threads, but if you take thousands of threads and you really interweave them so that they are deeply interdependent, they become a piece of fabric that is so enormously strong." Are we living that out here? Are we stronger because we're a church? Are we just a bunch of individuals living individual lives beside one another? Because there's a difference. And the church is a family, but it's an open family. It's one that says, if you would come in and if you would call Christ Lord, then you're part of it too. Galatians 6:2 tells us, "Carry one another's burdens in a way, in this way you will fulfill the law of Christ." This is the life of the church, isn't it? We do more than look out for our own biological family, because the church really is a family itself. And it's a family that serves those outside of the family too. We don't just look after this household that is the church. Rather, the church globally turns its focus to those outside of its doors and says, we want to make sure you're okay too. This whole life, it's all about orienting yourself towards other people. That's what the Christian life is about. Jesus calls us to die to ourselves and to follow him. And just the simplest, most obvious implication of that, that we'll love other people. Just blatantly apparent in Scripture. David Gibson, again in his book, Living Life Backwards, "It's possible to know the price of everything, but the value of nothing. If the love of money is the root of evil, then Ecclesiastes, and indeed the whole Bible, has a beautifully simple solution. Here's how you sever the root, stop the rot, kill the evil. Spend your money on others. Give it away. Do it regularly, gladly, generously, and you will be happy. For the preacher, the value of life is not what you earn, but whom you relate to. It's not what you buy, but what you give." It's there in black and white in chapter 4, verses 9 through 12. We are given a presentation of why two are better than one, and why three are even better than two. If you want to make money, do it with someone else, and you might make even more. But at least there's someone to share it with. We, not me, is always going to be better than me and only me. This is how God has designed us to flourish. And then later he poses the question, "I wonder what the impact would be on our families if there were husbands and dads who every now and then ask the question, ask the how are we doing question." And I don't think that's too provocative, but the next question he asks is, "Have you ever asked it in the church family as you look around on a Sunday morning?" I love that question. Let it linger for a moment. Do you ever look around here and ask, how are we doing? Not just me, but we. Not just how am I doing? Not just how is my mental health? Not just how is my spiritual well-being? Not just do I have enough food? Not just is my house cool enough in this horrible stretch of hot days we've been having? Not just is my house good? Not just are my bills paid? No, how are we doing? How is this family doing? Is there a need here that I can help with? Some of you, this is the air you breathe. This is how you live. This is how you treat the church. And God bless you. That is incredible. And you're exemplary to me even. Some of us, though, this might be a bit of a foreign thought this morning. It's just the church I go to. People need to stand on their own two feet. Can't worry about other people. Have to worry about myself. It's their problem, not mine. Of course, you can't not take care of your family. But the question is, are you at rest this morning? Is one handful enough? And if you find yourself with two handfuls this morning, is it enough? And what's it for? It's to bless other people. Do you ask the question, how are we doing, rather than how am I doing? If you see a need here, are you quick to help? Is it a joy to help with it? Community is so much of God's answer to our prayers. It should be. I was lonely, but then God gave me the church. God, I need help. And then God gave me the church. God, I can't do this thing. Oh, then God gave me the church. It has been that way for me time and time again. And I hope you're both having that experience here at the table, that the church is there for you. But I also hope you're going beyond that and you're being the church that is there for other people. Qohelet says, and if someone overpowers you, one person as one person, two can resist him, and a cord of three strands cannot easily be broken. Alone, we're easily overpowered, easily beaten down, alone, discouraged, lacking in some, if not many ways. In community, we're less of those things. God did not make you to pursue the best for yourself and yourself only until you die. God made you to die to yourself and live for him, and subsequently to live for others, in doing so to find the most full life. And ironically, as this passage says, not even the happiest life. It's not that it's not happy. I think largely it is a life marked by joy. But the word Qohelet uses in verse 6 is rest. It's peace. Do you want peace this morning? Do you want rest this morning? Listen to Chesterton's advice from earlier. Don't keep trying to accumulate more. Rather, desire less. Listen to Gibson's advice from earlier. Spend your money on others. Give it away. Do it regularly, gladly, generously. And do this life alongside other people, with other people, regularly asking the question, how are we doing? How are we doing? Not how am I doing, how are we doing? Look around this room this morning and ask that question. And then if the answer ever comes up, not great, lean into that. Lean into that with your heart. Lean into that with your time. And yes, lean into that with your treasure, your money, your stuff. Michelle, you can come up. The teacher this morning tells us in this passage and throughout Ecclesiastes, if you're chasing your worth, you're chasing the wind. You can climb the corporate ladder. You can earn and invest and grow your portfolio. You can get promotion after promotion. Upgrade your house, upgrade your car, get a pool, get a boat, get a vacation home. None of it can ever give you significance. None of it can ever provide you lasting satisfaction. It only distracts from the reality that under the sun, it's all meaningless. Yes, Qohelet tells us, enjoy good things, but don't ever think for a moment that they're ultimate things. Find a life where enough is enough. Jesus lived the most significant, meaningful life imaginable. And he lived it as a virtually homeless, itinerant preacher with little to show for it. No fancy cars or toys. But he was rich in his relationship with God, and he was rich in relationships with others. He was deeply connected with other people. He did life and ministry with other people, and they gave him very little in many ways. Fell asleep on the night he needed them the most when he asked them to keep watch and pray. Denied him in the midst of him being unjustly accused. And yet Jesus asked the question, how are we doing? How are we doing? He asked that question about his friends. And ultimately, in a way, he asked that question about you and I. He saw our need, and he ran towards it. He didn't fold his arms and withdraw. He ran towards a cross. He didn't just give some money or let people sleep in his guest room when their AC wasn't working. He gave his very life so that we might live. Jesus is the example of how to live this life of asking, how are we doing? may we follow him. Jesus, who on the night that he was betrayed took the bread, and after he gave thanks, broke it, saying, "This is my body broken for you. Do this in remembrance of me." In the same way, after supper, he took the cup, and again giving thanks, he said, "This is a new covenant in my blood for the forgiveness of sins." We take the bread and dip it in the cup every week, remembering how Jesus saw our need and didn't say, "Well, that's unfortunate. I have my own life to live." But gave up his life for our need. Communion here at the table is your time to sit and reflect. And the reflection point is obvious this morning, is it not? How are we doing? Look around the room. How are we doing? Is there a need you know about this morning that you could help with? Is there a way that you personally could help the answer to that question be more positive? The world, our culture, even our own hearts are constantly yelling, "Prove yourself." But Jesus says, "Rest in me." You have nothing to prove. Come this morning to the table receiving, not striving. Better one handful with rest. Communion can be found towards the back on my left. Gluten-free communion, if you need it, towards the back on my right. My friends Randy and Rachel are going to be available to pray for you this morning on either side of the room. And I would urge you to go to them for prayer. If you see this morning this text, you hear this and you think, "I'm not okay. There's something in my life where I'm not okay." Go and ask for prayer. So I'm gonna pray here in a moment. You're gonna have time to sit and reflect about maybe needs that you've seen, about your own attitude towards the one handful that you have, or maybe your own attitude towards the two handfuls that you have, your own attitude towards work. And then when you're ready, you can stand up and take the bread and dip it in the cup and take communion, remembering what Jesus has done for you. Father, I'm so grateful for your word, for the things you teach us, the hard truths you teach us. It can be a jarring, difficult experience to see that the idol that we're running to for worth is always going to come up empty for us. It can be disorienting. Father, if anyone is feeling that way through this series this morning, I pray that you wouldn't ease the truth that our idols will fail us, that you wouldn't soften that in their hearts, but rather that you would be a Jesus. You would be a friend, a companion that comes and puts an arm around people who are experiencing the loss of an idol. They might see you for who you are, turn towards you, and find life. And find the life of fulfillment, the life of peaceful rest, the life of enough. Because you are enough. If we have you, we have everything. In Jesus' name, amen.
Thanks so much for listening to our Sunday service. If you're interested in joining us in the future, you can find us at 17766 Cleveland Avenue Northwest on Sunday mornings at 10. Additionally, we host a meal every first and third Sunday after service in order to fellowship with one another. Visit aseatforyou.org for more information. We hope you'll join us next week. Go in peace.